First case, please.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is John Sheldon, and I represent Juan Dominguez. I intend to reserve approximately 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Right.
The question for this court is whether there's a reasonable probability that the jurors would have had a reasonable doubt respecting Dominguez's guilt if the word permanent had been included in the jury instructions. In determining Dominguez's intent, this court has said that it's proper for a court to consider not only the method by which a victim is wounded, but also the circumstances under which that injury was inflicted. This court, of course, recently decided Burkeen on October 31st of 2013. And in deciding Burkeen, and in discussing at least four cases similar to Burkeen, this court, in looking at the circumstances to determine whether the assailant had the requisite intent, the specific intent to permanently disable or disfigure, this court looked at the entire assault. This court looked at the relationship of the parties, the motivation for the fight, the facts leading up to the assault, how the weapon was used, if there was a weapon, the acts of the defendant immediately after the assault, whether the assault was stopped spontaneously or by some acts of a third party, and the seriousness of the injury. In this case, the relation of the party militates strongly for finding that there was no intent to permanently disable. The parties had known each other. The parties had been acquaintances. On the day of the assault, they had met each other in front of a 7-Eleven. They were friendly with each other. Of course, the victim was quite drunk. He had been refused service at a restaurant because he had said at trial he had had at least 6 beers. He had gone to the 7-Eleven, was refused service again of alcohol. But instead of not drinking, of course, he shared a beer with Dominguez. And in sharing that beer, it was a friendly sharing of beer. And the assailant, the victim, shared his story with Dominguez of the robbery that had occurred earlier. Of course, the victim had participated in a failed drug buy in which he was robbed. The victim in this case, of course, looked like an easy mark to Dominguez. They were acquaintances. There was no quarrel between them. The victim was extremely drunk. And he talked of his money and his loss of $20 just a few minutes prior. The victim, in another, of course, this case, like many, has a series of bizarre facts. It's hard to really sort out what was going on with these guys. But the victim leaves Dominguez and goes to a car for some purpose, thinking maybe it's the police again. Doesn't see Dominguez and walks home. As he's going home, he's spontaneously attacked. He's hit, he's kicked, he's knocked to the ground. The record is unclear. It's been discussed in both briefs whether where he was hit. The record does not reveal where he was hit with a bat. But he was knocked to the ground, he was kicked, and he was helpless. And the assault only stopped when he provided his wallet voluntarily. Then it spontaneously stopped, and he left. When he left, he didn't go to the hospital, he didn't seek treatment, he went home. When he went home, his wife called the police. When the police got there, they didn't send him to the hospital for treatment because he was so seriously injured. Instead, they got an interpreter, and they did an interview. And they interviewed him and discussed with him what happened. And then they decided, okay, you should go to the hospital for outpatient treatment. He goes to the hospital, gets stitches, comes home. At trial, he appears at trial with no injuries. He refers twice to his injuries as scratches. The use of the bat in this case, I understand it is incredibly scary to a victim when somebody approaches them with a bat. An assailant with a bat can easily do serious damage to somebody. A bat can easily, with one blow, cause a concussion. With several blows, as this court has seen several times, and I've had several cases, kill somebody with just a few blows. But that's not what happened in this case. What happened is, even though the victim was defenseless, even though the victim did nothing to stop this, no third party stopped this, the assault was stopped spontaneously by the assailants when the wallet was proffered by the victim. That fact that the victim was hardly hurt, he had 18 stitches, he had 6 stitches and 12 stitches.
That's hardly hurt?
Yes.
But counsel, let me actually move on. When you talk about the fact that there was that he was intending to take the wallet, that's actually the motive for why he was doing it.
Yes.
That's not the intent.
No. All the circumstances of the case, it is perfectly reasonable to say he both had a motive to rob and an intent to permanently disfigure. Yes. Those things are not inconsistent. Absolutely not. But the motive to rob doesn't form this court in looking at all the circumstances as to what the intent was.
Well, the motive is irrelevant to whether there was an intent to permanently injure or not to permanently injure.
I would disagree, Your Honor. I would say this court has consistently looked at all the circumstances. And the fact that a wallet was provided and the assault stopped, there are two. Let me say
that
there are two.
Is it necessary to use a baseball bat in order to rob him?
No, it's not necessary at all. He could have used a knife, could have used a gun. But if he
or just his fists.
If he used a gun.
But in Burkeen, we found that fists alone are sufficient to show permanence.
That's right. This court in Burkeen refused to have a conclusive or irrebuttable presumption that the use of a certain weapon means no intent to permanently disable, and the use of a weapon means a conclusive or irrebuttable presumption that there is. This court instead in Burkeen looked at all the facts. This court has consistently looked to all the circumstances. A reasonable inference of using the bat is that the assailants intended to permanently injure him or disfigure him in order to rob him. That's a reasonable inference, but a more reasonable inference is that the use of the bat was in order to rob the victim, use sufficient force to scare him and get the money, and they stopped when they got what they wanted.
Cal, can you answer your question?
I have another one.
Go ahead.
If indeed both of those are reasonable inferences, how do you meet your standard for habeas?
Well, my standard is below a preponderance of the evidence. My standard is whether the jurors could have found on the evidence a reasonable doubt concerning Dominguez's intent. Those two hypotheticals, the one that the assailants were more, I think it's more reasonable to think, because the victim was so drunk and defenseless, that the assailants were trying to scare him to get his wallet. I think that's more reasonable. But if there were two equally reasonable inferences, my standard proof is below hundreds of evidence. It's only whether it's reasonably likely that the jurors would have had a reasonable doubt.
But hasn't the jury already decided that your client intended to maim, disfigure, disable, or kill the individual? The question is whether he intended to permanently do it or just do it for a little while.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. The question here is not, the jury found that they intended to disable him. That's exactly what you do with a robbery. If they used a knife, if they used a gun, this court would find it easy to say this question should go to the jury, because a gun, you would have shot him. But he didn't.
Counsel,
now, in this case...
Counsel, if I recall the facts correctly, it wasn't just that they were wielding a bat. They just weren't threatening him by waving it around. They were actually hitting him in the head with the bat. Aren't those the facts of the case?
No, Your Honor. There are no facts to indicate that he was hit in the head with the bat. The facts indicate...
Didn't Mr. Dominguez... No, the victim say that he was hit in the head with the bat.
No, Your Honor. The victim never stated that, and the Commonwealth focused on that in closing argument and said that he was never hit in the head with a bat, that injury on his head could have just as easily come from a fist or a boot. Yes.
Or a boot. So bat, yes. Or boot. If you're kicking someone in the head with a boot or hitting someone in the head with a bat, wouldn't that lead to a conclusion that you intended to permanently disable them?
Not a conclusive. If this court wants to look at the use of the bat and say there is a conclusive presumption then this court would have to overturn Schmidt and Sandstrom v. Montana and all the cases in which it says you cannot have a conclusive presumption, you cannot have an irrebuttable presumption of intent from the facts. You have to look at all the circumstances. And this court has consistently...
You have to look at all of the circumstances, but one fact could stand out, and that fact, if I'm being hit in the head with two baseball bats or kicked in the head with two sets of boots, what conclusion could the jury draw from that other than permanency?
Because the jurors asked when the photos were taken and asked for the photos, because the jurors asked, what is the definition of disabled? There was a lot of discussion in the briefs about what is the meaning of the jury asking for the definition of disabled.
We don't speculate about what the jury meant.
Your Honor, I absolutely disagree. There is one, you don't speculate, but there is one circumstance where this court again and again has found meaning in a jury's question, and that is when they've had an incorrect instruction. When the jurors have been incorrectly instructed, and then they ask a question about an incorrect instruction, in those cases, this court has found that meaningful in analyzing whether there is prejudice. In orthopedics and sports physical therapy versus Summit Group, the jury was incorrectly instructed on the liability of the LLC. When the jurors asked a question, what about the liability of the LLC? If one member had taken the wrong action, could the LLC be liable? This court found that important in its prejudice analysis because the question was about an incorrect instruction. In Holmes v. Levine, the jury was incorrectly instructed about proximate cause. The jurors asked a question about proximate cause, and this court said the issue of proximate cause was a question, was the subject of a question from the jury during the course of its deliberation. And this court found it meaningful when, with an incorrect instruction, this is the only circumstance I have found in which this court has found a jury's question to be relevant in its analysis. Of course, I also cite a South Carolina case in my brief in which the jury asked a question about an incorrect instruction. The court found that was very relevant to its analysis of whether that instruction was important and whether there was prejudice in the case. Further, this court has said that a case only weakly supported by the evidence, is more likely to be affected by errors than one that's strongly supported. Of course, this is a case where there was a mistrial, and then it was retried. And then in this case, the jurors took 7 hours to deliberate. The circuit court judge, at the motion to strike, was shaking his head and said, this is not a strong case. It is not a strong case, but I don't think I can grant this motion to strike.
But doesn't it matter why it's not a strong case? Because
yes.
I thought your client's defense is that it wasn't me.
Absolutely.
I mean, we were just sharing a beer. The guy's my friend. Why would I be hitting him with a bat?
Absolutely.
And then the jury decided that against him. So, I mean,
you're absolutely right. But it was a weak case on every ground. It was a weak case on the robbery, in which, of course, there was an incorrect jury instruction on the robbery also. It was a weak case on the ID, and it was a weak case on the intent to permanently disable. If it pleases the court, may I reserve the remainder of my time?
All right.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, John Blanton on behalf of the respondent and the warden. If I may, I'd like to just point out from the beginning that the petitioner has two things to prove: the counsel's performance was deficient, and that he was prejudiced by that deficient performance. It wasn't raised below on this issue, but it was repeated throughout the arguments below that counsel's strategy at trial was that this was not the man who did this crime. He was vigilantly pursuing one defensive strategy while he ignored another potential strategy. That is inherently not deficient, not ineffective assistance of counsel. Williams v. Kelly in the Fourth Circuit.
Yeah, are you saying that giving a wrong jury instruction is a strategic trial decision?
I didn't say it was a strategic choice. You're vigilantly pursuing one strategy and you ignore another. It is not.
But that doesn't justify, does it, giving a jury instruction that's incorrect?
I'm
that doesn't justify giving a jury instruction that's incorrect.
I don't think there's any justification.
So are you saying there wasn't deficit performance?
I'm saying it could be found. I think there's an argument the counsel was not deficient in doing this because he was.
I think you might want to move on to your next argument.
Thank you for the answer. On the prejudice, I think it's clear that the evidence was not weak, that this was malicious wounding. The petitioner has argued that the Commonwealth, in its closing arguments, was ignoring the malicious wounding. But in two places, the Commonwealth said it can be no question that this is malicious wounding. There is no doubt that the victim was that Mr. Marroquin was the victim of a malicious wounding. It was clear when you ambush somebody in the middle of the night, you go to a dark area, you jump out with baseball bats, you assault him with baseball bats, knock him to the ground, and then begin to kick him repeatedly. You don't ask for money. You don't ask for anything. The victim says, I thought they were going to kill me. His head is split open in two places. He's in pain all over. He is kicked repeatedly. It is only when he says, let me give them my money to see if that will stop them, that they do stop. They pick up the wallet, and he flees home at that point. I don't find that to be a weak case for malicious wounding. And I don't think anybody would argue that. And I don't think he's established a reasonable probability that a jury would not have found this was malicious wounding, that there was an intent to permanently injure. I think if you look at the judge's findings, he was very clear about this. Judge Bellows said, you've got being hit about the head, you've got being hit with baseball bats, pain all over. He looked at all these factors and found the evidence was more than sufficient.
What do you say that we should do or not do with regard to the jury question in this case?
I'm sorry, I'm not sure.
The jury asked a question about the meaning of disabled, I think. I'm paraphrasing.
Oh, okay. I wasn't sure which question you were asking.
The appellant has asked or has argued that that's a significant factor that we should consider in making our prejudice analysis. I'm asking you what's your position with what we do with that question.
I apologize. I wasn't sure what question you were referring to. I think it's clear on brief that we think that should be given no weight. We have no idea what that meant. Was that one juror's question? Was it the whole jury's question?
Well, that doesn't matter. It only takes one jury to hang the jury.
That's true. But I think just as important is the question was, what does the legal definition of disabled have to do in deciding between malicious and unlawful wounding? And as the judge said, you've got the instructions, and the difference between these two charges is malice. The legal definition of disabled, to be honest with you, I don't even understand what the question was about. There was some confusion. That's all I can tell you by some juror. But we really, I think our precedent at this point is clear. We don't go back and look at the jury and their questions to figure out what the jury was doing. You're being asked to presume what the jury was doing, to speculate what the jury was doing. And I don't think it can be speculated there. I think that would be inappropriate. I think if you look at the case that he cited, orthopedic, that was a case where you had two jury instructions that were opposed to each other. And the case law in the Commonwealth is that is a cause for reversal unless you can prove that the jury was not misled. So in that particular case, to look at the question and that fact pointed out the jury was misled. It reinforced the case law so that was appropriate. That's not the case here. So I think that question, I think the jury's question doesn't have anything to do with this case. If there are no further questions, we would ask that you affirm the decision of the court below.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Rebuttal, sir?
Thank you, Your Honor. There really wasn't much brought up by the appellee that I need to respond to, except to make sure to focus this court on whether there's a reasonable probability of a different result is less than a preponderance of the evidence. When you look at the entire circumstances of this case, when you look at the relation of the parties, the fact that the victim was an easy mark, the fact that he was helpless, yet he was not seriously injured. If somebody wanted to seriously injure with a bat...
But how the result does not dictate the intent. He might have been so drunk that he couldn't figure out exactly where to hit him with the baseball bat. How does the result, the fact that he had 18 stitches instead of a fractured skull, relate to intent?
It relates. It's relevant. It's not dispositive. This court, in all the cases that it reviewed in Burkeen, talked about the extent of the injuries. And the extent of the injuries is not dispositive at all. This court can easily find a permanent injury. There's a case the court talked about where the orbital eye socket was broken and the victim had permanent damage, and this court found no intent to permanently disable. And there are cases in which the injuries are relatively minor, and this court has found intent to permanently disable. But it is relevant, and what I'm trying to focus on, and I'm missing with you, Your Honor, and I apologize, is that if I have these assailants must have been incredibly poor assailants, because if I have a baseball bat and I attack you with it, you are going to get more than 6 stitches above your eye. If I attack a helpless person on the ground with a baseball bat, you are likely going to die. You are definitely going to have a concussion. When I say, I don't mean to minimize the victim's injuries. I am talking about the injuries that he has in the context of what it looks like their intent was and the way they used the bat. And because they used a bat and he didn't have injuries that one would expect if I hit somebody with a bat, then it is reasonable to find that relevant to the inquiry of whether they intended to permanently disable.
Your time's expired.
Thank you.
Thank you. Call the next case, please.